Hello, welcome to Sacred Cheese of Life, episode 33, Objective Reading. This is Emma, and there's no such thing as objective reading, so that's going to slow us down. But it is something to strive for, so I wanted to talk about it in terms of, hi kitty, the animals are rampaging as usual. Hi kitty. I wanted to talk about it in terms of reading your own work in particular, but then it also made me think about something a student said and various questions about objectivity in analyzing fiction. Okay, so I read three books this week. I read a lot of books this week, but three in particular I want to talk about are three that I wrote, which I didn't even read on purpose. I was just anxious and bummed out, and I had my phone, and so I opened up Kindle, and it went right back to The Icarus Triptych, which is truly one of my favorite books, because it's somebody super anxious who figures a way out of it. She asks for help, which she does not usually do, and she gets the help, and she accepts that a thing is bad that she thought was good, and is then therefore able to find a better thing that she didn't expect and wasn't looking for and didn't know she would ever find, and had to accept that this was a good thing for her. So it's like all these major psychological things to get over, and she does it coming from a place of like, oh no, I'm panicking, I'm in a strange place, I have this crazy job that's a million hours a day, it's really hard, I have no car, I don't really know anybody, the only people I know both left town, like everybody left, and here I'm on my own, and it's very hard. That's extremely hard. And she's young and she doesn't have the wherewithal. She has no money. She does, but she can't get it. So she doesn't have it. So she's in a really bad spot. And I like the book for so many reasons, not least of which is Finn. I like Finn as a character. I've talked about this before. And I don't mean to keep crowing about my own book, but when I read it, it's like I didn't write it. So I don't know. I like it as a reading experience. I like the characters of Harriet and Finn. I like Isaiah, who's a butthead. I like how he gradually turns to become this other version of himself, from a self-sufficient guy to like, oh, I get to go be a kid. I'm going to be a kid. So he like ungrows up, he grows down, he grows back, he's ingrown. He becomes problematic by his choices. There's just really interesting characters. There's Aristide. I love Aristide. Anyway, all this fun stuff happens and it's really cool. Yay. Anyway, I didn't mean to read it, like I said, and I just opened my phone and there it was at chapter 7. What a surprise, my favorite chapter, where everything kicks off. It's literally the axis upon which the entire trilogy turns. So that's where things start to turn. It's where the character gets appreciated for the things she can do. And she has had a history of not being appreciated for herself, but rather for like, she's an audience, or she, you know, they think they're going to get something because they're around her. Like all this gross, like just really, when people don't like you for you, but for something else, that's another theme of the book. It's something that Finn struggles with a lot. And so it's just, it's a good read, and I enjoyed it as an outsider coming to it again, because every time I'm like, how in the world, like I find the beginning up to chapter 7 so stressful that it's hard for me to read it because, and again, I wrote it because she's in such a bad spot, right? So coming at something you have written yourself objectively is very difficult unless you have no memory like me, and then it's kind of easy. And you get to laugh at all your own jokes because you don't remember they're in there, which is also really fun. Believe it or not, there are upsides to no memory. Objectivity for your own writing is one of them. For example, I found typos. This is the ebook that I have on my phone is an older edition, so like it contains typos that had long been fixed. But I found some new ones or errors, like Maizewood, which I think I mentioned before. I wrote in third person and then had to go through, sorry for the vocal fry, had to go through and change to first person, which is extremely hard to do for an entire like 120,000 word novel, because you can't search on like she, change it to I. You can't, because there's other she's. You know what I mean? So you have to go through and read it word for word for word and catch everything. And I didn't. I missed some. And again, I had gone back and fixed a lot of them. Once I got the proof, my proof I gave away to a student, it was full of pencil marks and sticky notes marking where all the marks were. So I had to do that. And then I found more. I found several more. I think three more this time. And then, man, if I didn't get to book one and find three spots where I called Uncle Harry Uncle Henry, which is probably his legal name, but it's a mistake. It's just a mistake. People make mistakes, even us. And, you know, we're awesome. That sucked, finding that. And then I went and did a search on Henry and replaced Henry with Harry, all of them, like a global replace, which we all know not to do. Don't do that. Look at each one. And also make sure you always do entire word. Everybody's probably had the experience, who is full of mistakes like me, of changing a name like Tim or something to something like, say, Jack. And then suddenly it's instead of in his estimation, it's in his S-Jackmation, right? Just S-Jackation. Like, it, don't do that. Do whole word only. You know now. But I, of course, all of us have had to learn the hard way usually. I did that. I replaced all of them and then later remembered that they talk about Henry V in that book. So I went back and looked, and sure enough, it said Harry V. So that's annoying. And so I had to correct my correction and re-uploaded those today. So that's great. I'm full of mistakes. We're all full of mistakes. When you read your work, you are going to find mistakes. And that's no fun. However, you're also going to find out what works. And reading these three books this week, I was able to be analytical in a way while I was enjoying them. I do enjoy them, although really the first one is so stressful. Because again, it's Harriet. She's like, oh no, my uncle I was living with died and now I don't know what the hell to do. And also, who's this aunt? I never heard of her. And that's weird. And nobody believes she is who she says she is. And she's like, well, I am. And the lawyer believes it. So I'm inheriting and you're out. Because she was supposed to, Harriet, everyone expected Harriet to inherit. But then things get weird. And there's the thing I love about the way it's written, and I can't take credit. I did not write it this way. I rewrote it this way. And that's a crucial thing to remember, is every, it's like dominoes. She knocks over one thing. The aunt is there and wants to see her artwork. And so she shows her her artwork, but then realizes there's a lot of paintings of her boyfriend that are revealing that. And then later he's upset and like she didn't think about it, or she was like, well, it's art. You know, I painted it. It's mine, not yours. And he's like, yeah, but, and then breaks up with her, leaves, gone, you know, and steals the artwork. And then later on burns a bunch of it. So like it sets off, that sets off the next thing and sets off the next thing. And all of it sets off all these things. And then finding out this thing later on, she goes running away. She just like runs away. Which is such a relatable act that I'm like, oh, yeah, I did write this. Like, she's like, ah, this is overwhelming. I have to go. I have to go. I have to go out the door and just go. And that happens to some of us. And so that sets off just this great thing that I love, like finding all these things that she found hidden around the house she grew up in. And because she was always like treasure. She was always, because the family kept talking about how this daughter of the earlier generation had hidden all these treasures. And she was like, treasure? I'm going to go look for treasure. So she searched the entire house while she was an unattended child, found all these treasures. Some of them were like champagne corks or tin soldiers, but some of them turned out to be actual treasures. So she goes and hides them as a child all around the property, because that's what you're supposed to do with treasure. You're supposed to bury it. And so when she runs away, she goes out and finds all these things because she says she doesn't want this place to have any pieces of her heart, which hurts to read because she, in book three, ends up going back there. But anyway, she finds all these treasures and then they end up saving her parents, which is like, I get mad reading these books because I really like them and I really like how they're structured. Stay with me. And I feel like I can't do that now, but then I have to remember over and over and over, again and again and again, You did not write the book. You wrote a draft of the book. You wrote a draft. A draft is not the same as a final copy. A draft is going to be full of holes, like my memory, and suck, like my memory. And it's going to have problems, like, again, my memory. And so you don't have to write. Like, I couldn't write those books. Nobody could write those books. You don't write those books. I wrote a draft. And I wish I had saved, like, you know, every draft with a date on it. For all I know, I did. Who knows? Nobody knows. And then I could go back and be like, oh, yeah, in the beginning, this and that and that. And then it was changed to this. And then it was changed to this. And it was changed to this. I don't have all that. Or maybe I do, but I don't remember it. And so, like, that would help me, because then I would remember, oh, yeah, you write a draft. You write a draft. It's okay if your draft sucks, which is one reason I was in despair, because I read my draft of Summerlands and I was like, there's a lot I don't like. There's a lot I don't like. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, I have the power to change that. And I'm like, oh, no, I have to change it. Yay, power, boo, I have to do things. That's a big, big job. And so I keep starting rewrites of Summerlands. And then I get a certain distance and I'm like, veered off the road. It's like I'm trying really hard to steer it down this one specific path. But then when I'm writing, I can't think about that. I can't look at the map and drive at the same time. And so I write and then it goes off the path and I'm like, ah, and I have to stop. And then I have to go back and start again and come back to that point and make sure to get it back on the road. Get on the road. Don't go off the road. And so I keep doing that. And so I've done like 3, 5, I don't know, rewrites of the first 100 pages of this book, because that's where it gets off the rails mostly. I had all these things going on where in retrospect, I'm like, ugh, don't, yikes. No, I don't, because you have a character who's, once again, it's a theme. I mean, I did write all these things. Trapped, stuck somewhere, has no money. This is a recurring terror of mine, obviously, because it happened a bunch of times. Ugh. Now I'm only trapped by my psychology, which is somehow just as hard to deal with. But anyway, she's trapped, has no money. And this time, this last rewrite, last night, I'm like, you know what? There's a hotel walking distance away. Because I was like, well, she's out in the middle of... No, she lives next door to a hotel. She works housekeeping at the hotel. She has the crappiest job, the one that doesn't pay well, and she does it, and it's hard work, and she walks over there and does it, and she'll work any shift. She doesn't care. Obviously, she's been doing it as long as, you know, as young as they would let her. And she's been doing it every summer, and on vacations, she does this job. And so I like a person who works better than I like a person who doesn't work. And it doesn't matter anything else about them. I just like them better if they work. We also hate helplessness. And learned helplessness is a whole thing. And it's another theme in all my work for obvious reasons. And we don't find it sympathetic, even though we can understand, I wrote it and I don't find it sympathetic. I have it and I don't find it. It's especially unsympathetic because I have it. And I'm like, well, I can't fix it. I can't control anything. Yeah, you know what? You can. You can't make people hire you, but you can make yourself apply. You can apply. You are not in control of all the consequences of your actions, but you are in control of your actions. Does this sound like I have to tell myself this all the time? It's true. Oh, it's hard. It's hard when you've been specifically raised to be helpless. Abusive people like their victims to be helpless and to believe they can't get away and they can't do the things and they have no power. They want that because it makes their job easier. This is obvious. This is like psychology 101. It is a really hard thing to unlearn when you've been taught it very carefully, very thoroughly for a very long time by people who are much more powerful than you. And so it's something I fight with all the time, like today and yesterday and tomorrow, you know? And so I give it to characters. And of course, Harriet was dealing with it. She had to overcome it. Isaiah had it in book one. He had to overcome it. There's a conversation they have where they're both like, well, she has it with her aunt. And she's like, but how do I wouldn't even know how to begin going to California and getting an apartment. Her aunt's like, what are you talking about? You look in the advertisements. You go look at the places, like you apply to jobs and then eventually somebody hires you. And until then you temp. Like this is not rocket science, but she's again been trained to be helpless. And it gets reinforced because people who like helpless people like having helpless people around and will reinforce that and reinforce being that way. And so, yes, this is a thing. This is a whole thing. And if you don't know about it, go look it up. And if you do have it and didn't know, like I have run into students who didn't know they had it, like, oh, no, you are in control of your own destiny. And I had a student go, oh, no, when I said that. She was horrified by that. But she was in an abusive relationship and she was in like a domestic abuse situation. Really upsetting, that poor girl. And I hope she's long out of it. That was a very, very long time ago, like in the aughts. And so anyway, that's ancient history. But it's beaten into people literally that they are helpless. And it's very hard. What are you supposed to do? Beat it back out of yourself? Like how? You have to do one thing at a time and take those steps and realize, oh, I can change things. Oh, I can do this. Oh, I can do this. And it's just really, really hard. So I gave it to this girl, Lisette, and then giving her this job suddenly helped fix it. So she can still feel helpless in a lot of ways, but she's taking steps. And this was, again, yesterday's rewrite. I did like 85 pages of rewrite. I changed a lot of things, not just this. Like I changed a lot of things. Nobody cares. Specifics in a book you cannot read and have not read. But I changed a lot of things that gave her more agency. Because she does have agency. Just because a character, and this is where I'm getting back to objectivity, just because a character feels like they have no agency does not mean they have no agency. Like, people do stuff all day, every day, whether they believe they can or not, they do. And this is where you get like, I don't feel like I can control the world, but suddenly I'll, you know, get in touch with these people out way the hell over there and go get this, you know, insane 1800 sofa that I can't stop talking about, even though I don't pay any attention to it because I'm on an upholstery mandated break mandated by pain. Really helps a lot not doing that. Also, the house is very neat, which I like a lot. But like, I made that happen. I made that happen. I've reupholstered huge objects. I made that happen. Why do you still think you can't control things when obviously you can control things? Well, it's self-reinforcing and it's safe. Like, Lisette feels trapped because she kind of is trapped. But she never thinks like, well, I want a divorce from this awful dude who's being really, really unkind to her. Like, cold, cruel, callous, confining. What other words start with C that we can call him? I can think of a few choice ones. I've given him many more things because it was always just like, she's like, well, he doesn't let me go anywhere. And then you realize she gives up. She gives up trying to go places because she's tired of the fights. And that is another, like, I don't know if that's capitulation. There's another C word. It's not so much helplessness as choosing your battles, but sometimes you choose wrong. Choosing, there's another C word. She made the wrong choices. She chose wrong when she picked the guy. She chose wrong when she married the guy. She just chose. She was upset and feeling lost and helpless. And like, what am I going to do? I can't think of any solutions. I'm going to do this. And she was young, and young people and all old people and every kind of people, we all make terrible mistakes. We make bad choices. She made a choice. She's dealing with the consequences. But making it so that we see, so it's not just her reporting that, oh, it's terrible, I can't get out. Like, instead of that, we get to see what actually, like, what did he actually do? Because I just pictured her talking to a therapist who would be like, okay, but what does he actually do? And she's like, well, he doesn't talk to me. So do you talk to him? No, because he doesn't want to talk to me. And then you start realizing this person has built up this whole structure in their head that makes it so they don't have to talk to the person who they feel uncomfortable talking with, right? Right. We all do this again. We build structures and then they're comfortable and then we reinforce them with belief and self-fulfilling prophecies and things like that. We all do this. This is all, again, psychology. Okay, so objective reading of Summerlands was like, oh no, it sucks. It sucks as a final book, sure. As a draft, it's perfectly great. It's not done. It's going to need a bunch more rewrites. And how fun is that to have to go over and over and over and over the same thing and make it better and better and better? Because I'm always like, well, why don't I just do it all the first time? I have impossibly high standards, and then I get mad that I can't fulfill them. Oh no, where'd you get that from? You get one guess. That's no good either. So yeah, you're going to have to go over it 100 times, and the 100 may be literally true, because we are not good at being objective. We're not good at it. Witness Uncle Henry. An objective reader would have looked at every word on every page and noticed that 3 in the first 10 pages said Henry. And I probably named him Henry first and changed it to Harry and didn't go back and read over that carefully enough and never noticed. I fixed it Friday. These books came out in 2023. I wrote them in 2019. So like somewhere between 2019 and Friday, one would have hoped I would have looked at it more carefully, like in the proof stage, maybe, right? Or any of the stages between then and printing out a whole stack of them last fall. What am I going to do? Put a post-it note over it? I meant Harry. Like, cross it off? Oh, man. Oh, well, nothing I can do about that. So objectivity would be ideal, but we are not good at that. And like I said, I get wrought up. I get wrought up by my own stories that I've read before and, as mentioned, wrote. I got so upset by the memory of a short video I saw on Friday. I don't think I've been sleeping well. That I couldn't, like, I got terrified out in the yard because of this stupid short video. Okay, this is the stupid short video. Speaking of objectivity, this is fake. It's not like it's a real thing. There's like a 20-foot Santa, okay, kneeling. Actually, somebody showed me a video of it, and it's not the one I saw. It's a different one. The one I saw, I think, was black and white. I'm not sure. But it's a different angle. And so I'm not sure if my memory is bad, speaking of objectivity, or what. Or if the person made more than one, which is likely, I think. So there's like a 20-foot Santa, and in my memory, what you see is he walks up to the door of the house, and the person, it's like a POV, a point of view, the point of view. You never see the person, you only see their point of view, okay? So that makes it actually more effective, I think. You see what they see, you don't see them. So the person's looking through the window, sees this gigantic, scary Santa figure kneeling down or coming to the door, and then the Santa turns around and sees the person, and the person, you can also hear them in the background going like that scary, you know, fear panting, and that makes it much scarier too. So they duck behind a curtain or out of their view, and then when they peek around again, the Santa is right there, like staring right in the window, and they have glowing eyes. See how not scary that is? But it terrified me. And there's another video of somebody driving, and there's a person, a guy, wearing like a bodysuit who's all dark, but has also glowing eyes or reflective eyes, I think. And they're running as like faster than anybody can run next to the car. They're running and running and running, and they're looking into the car. And those are two similar terrifying, like, fragments of video. Objectively, I know that is not reality. Those things are not in the yard. The thing that is in the yard is my big black dog who would protect me from anything. She's been protecting me from a little blue bird that is made of like ceramic or something, melamine or something, all day long because I moved it. And she's like, ah, what's that? Bark, bark, bark. And then I show it to her and she's like, okay, I guess. And then I put it back, and then next time she sees it, she's like, ah, what's that? Bark, bark, bark. So we have a lot in common. But anyway, there's nothing in the yard that's going to hurt me. There really isn't. It's winter in Maine. Like, the bears are asleep. There's nothing else that could hurt me anyway. I suppose a mountain lion might be passing through. There was a lynx in western Maine. I have a big black dog. If she's barking like that at a little melamine bird that is not even moving, do you think anything is going to get by her? No. She freaked out the other day because the lid of a mason jar went boink. And she was like, ah, what's that? Bark, 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 bark. She's on high alert, much like my limbic system or whatever. So anyway, I thought about those two things, the scary running Santa and the scary running man, and got freaked out coming in the door of the house because I turned off the light before the door was shut. And I was like, they're going to get me. So I'm still 4. So that's good to know. There's nothing under the bed, though, except the kitty. I'm not scared of under the bed anymore, which is, I guess, progress. I was terrified of under the bed as a kid. The thing about being scared of under the bed is your fear is not wrong. It's just aimed in the wrong direction. There are things to be afraid of, and you don't see them, so you imagine whatever else it might be, right? You're not wrong. Fear is correct. It's just not, you know, there isn't a scary running man in the yard. There isn't a 20-foot Santa with glowing eyes in the yard. It's something else, and you're afraid of something else. And objectively, you can figure it out if you can step back and be, you know, less, what's the opposite of objective? Subjective, be less subjective about it. But that's hard to do when you're a fear-based organism. Objective reading of these three books, what did it do for me? Okay, besides just telling me, you know, a draft is a draft and a finished book is a finished book and they are not the same things. And, you know, even my memory, I remembered, and I would have probably said that in 2019, 2020, I just wrote and wrote and wrote and I was all blissed out and it was wonderful. Well, I went back and looked at my journals yesterday and guess what? Nope. I wrote The Nerve in the fall of 2019, and I believe I started Leaving Thrushcross right like the next day, really, really soon after, which means I still had to rewrite The Nerve, and I had to finish Leaving Thrushcross, which is very hard for me to say, Thrushcross. And then I had to write The Icarus Triptych, because which I didn't even plan. It wasn't planned to be a trilogy. I wrote Leaving Thrushcross, and then I was like, but what happens next? I have to know. And I didn't know, and so I had to write it and find out, which is backwards, but that's how I do things, backwards. So anyway, I wrote it next, and then I wrote Maizewood, and then I do vaguely remember that I kind of ran out of steam halfway through Maizewood, possibly ran out of summer also, and went back to class. Although I'm not sure, we might have been online that fall, 2020? Can't remember. Ran out of steam for whatever reason. I had just written out all my words. That was four novels. I did finish them all within a 12-month period. So I did write four huge, the later three are huge, novels within a year, a 12-month period. And that's a lot. So in my memory, it was this blissful, like I can picture myself sitting in the mossy green chair in the north window in the living room where it used to be, not right next to me where it is now. And it was comfortable, and I was warm and safe, and the dog and the cat were there, and everything was fine. This is what I remember. Looking at my journals, it's like, oh no, I have $13 in the bank, and I had to use overdraft protection 3 times last week, and I'm trying to drive rideshare, and I can't make any money, and I went out, and there was no rides, and I went out another day, and there was no rides, and over, and there was no rides, and finally I was like, there's no rides, I can't earn any money doing this, and I was like freaking out, and my mom was being a monster, she was in bad shape and getting worse, and she started off mean, and she got meaner and meaner and meaner, and I had to go to all these meetings, like, with the home care people where they're like, she's really mean. And I'm like, oh no, I know. Believe me, I've known her my whole life. She's mean as a snake. And that was awful. And it was all just awful, right? And so my blissed out memory is so wrong. I mean, there were moments like that where I played Temple of the Dog. I played that one song by Temple of the Dog over and over and over again, like probably thousands of times, and wrote and was in this no time zone, like time had no meaning because it was the same song all the time, right? Yes, there was an element of that, but it wasn't what I remembered at all. And so it's good to keep a journal, I guess. Oh no. So objective memory is not a thing, is it? Memory tells you what it wants you to hear or tells you what you want to hear. Like I wanted to hear it was easy and straightforward and that's what I remembered, even though it meant that I couldn't do it anymore right now because it's not easy and straightforward. Summerlands has been a battle. You've been here the whole time. Oh boy, that book has been hard to write and it's still hard to write. It's not done by any means. It's like those myths of like, I'm going to get it out the end of December. No, it's not there yet. It needs to be better and better and better. Like, I can read it and go, okay, I guess. But that's not the reaction you want to have to a book. Sheesh, no. Anyway, as I was saying, objective reading of the trilogy after reading Summerlands, the draft, told me a bunch of things. And that includes I'll start with the first thing, which is mushy plots are bad. Like, you need to know what the person wants and why. You need to know what the stakes are and why. And you need that upfront, and you need it reiterated, because I will forget, your reader will forget, everyone forgets. And then they start asking things like, why doesn't she just go blah, blah, blah? Well, there's reasons, okay? And those reasons might include psychological damage or whatever, but they don't remember that, and they're not going to know it if you don't tell them. So, like, I made the plot really super clear in the first two books of the trilogy. The third one, it was just sort of understated. It was more like literary fiction, like, what are we doing with our lives? Am I doing it right? You know, and that is less clear. And that has always been my least favorite book, even though it's a great book. Like, every time I read it, I'm like, wow, this is actually really good. How come I never remember liking it? Like, it's really funny. There's a lot of jokes I really like. No way. You really like the jokes you wrote yourself? Yeah, I do. It's true. Like, there's constant jokes and Easter eggs. Like, if you're a reader of the books of Joan Aiken, you're going to love all the references that are thrown in there. There are quotes and things. And you would never know it if you didn't know it. But to me, I read it and I'm like, ah, I see that. there's jokes my brother makes. There's like all this good stuff in there. Like, they're fun to read. And even without that, they're super fun to read. And you're just like, wait, what? Why are you, character Harriet, why are you so unhappy? What's wrong? And she doesn't know, and she has to figure it out. And so that is complicated, right? That's a lot less clear of a plot. The third one has kind of a mushy plot. Like, and I know a friend of mine read it and said, no, it doesn't. It's very clear. She has to figure out how to live the life she's chosen. And I'm like, yeah, but that's so woolly. You know, that's not like, I have to earn money and get a job and find a place to live, which is the usual existential drama, which is the drama in the first two books. Like, how am I going to make this work? And then the third one, she's like, oh, I found a way to make it work. Now I have to figure out how to live with my choice, which is a much more adult kind of conversation to have with yourself. And she loses the ability to paint. She just can't do it suddenly. And that's, you know, she gets the yips, and then like she has to figure out how to overcome that. And she gets help from someone who has experience overcoming addiction. And that's interesting. Is it like addiction? Is art like addiction? Like, or is it like, it's like a skill that you have to do. You have to be able to believe in yourself that you can do this thing, and you have to do all of the hard technical stuff to be able to do this thing, and then you have to go and do it. And that is such a huge leap of faith every single time, every performance, every artwork, everything. It's hard, and it's psychological, and that's where the yips come in, right? Because that's when suddenly you stop being able to do this thing that you've done professionally well your whole life. A lot of like athletes, musicians get it. They just suddenly can't do it anymore. It happens to golfers a lot, apparently, who are extremely technically skilled, right? And they have all this talent, and they've gotten so far in their lives, and everybody's standing there quietly watching them, which has to suck. And then, although I've done plenty of performances, I mean, there's a lot of people quietly watching. I'm used to that. But like, all of a sudden, they can't do it, and they do it badly. And then they're like, oh, no, I've lost it. And then they can't do it. And sometimes it's a career ender. They get the yips, look it up, and then they can't do it anymore. And so I gave that to poor Harriet. After her abilities saved her life, suddenly, first they ruined her life, and then they saved her life. And then she can't do it anymore. And she's like, well, what if I can't do it anymore? Oh, no. What happens then? And there are other options. But what if the thing that you think makes you special gets taken away from you somehow, or you lose it somehow? Then what? And you've already committed to this course of action, you know? It's a big plot, but it's also like, I don't even know how I put it on the back of it. Like, how did I sum it up for the back of the book? It's hard to sum up. It's like I'm saying, it's a little woolly. And Summerlands is so much worse. It's so much worse. I don't know how I would sum up Summerlands either. And I was just like, oh no, what did I write? Oh, I haven't done it yet. I haven't needed to put it on the back of the book because there's no book. Okay, phew. I mean, there is. Oh no, I probably did put it because I already created it in KDP. I did create it in KDP. So there is something on the back of the book. Not that anybody but me can see it. So I wrote something. Goodness knows what. The hardest thing in the world is summarizing a book for the back of the book. Although I would pick it over rewriting Summerlands right now because it's just so hard. It's so hard because objectively that book's kind of sucked. It had this weak, like, learned helplessness character who made all these kind of gross choices, since deleted, that made you unsympathetic to her, which was on purpose. I did do that on purpose. I wanted her kids to read that and be like, eesh, both of my parents did a lot of terrible things. How am I going to manage that in my own mind? How am I going to deal with that? What am I going to do with that, now that I've learned it? Because they don't know their parents. And they're finding out, like, oh, they both. So I don't want to make her a saint. I want to make her make some bad choices, but they don't have to be gross, you know? Like, they don't have to be gross. I also want her to do a lot more running away, because she doesn't. She's just like, oh, I can't leave. Like, well, you have fate. Get going. And then I was like, well, he should take away her shoelaces. No, he should be awful and controlling the way his mom was to him. And that should be the thing that makes her stuck. Like, being psychologically controlled by somebody is so destructive to you. This is the battered woman syndrome, where yes, they could leave, but no, they can't leave. Like, there's reasons other than somebody putting handcuffs on you that you don't just walk away from a situation. And you can think of it like a bad job or any bad situation. Why don't you just quit? Why don't you just quit your job? And then you're like, well, nothing bad happened today. This is exactly battered woman. This is exactly what they say. It wasn't so bad today. I mean, I need the money, and it's going to be hard to find a new one. And people just start rationalizing these things away. Like, yeah, okay, if your job sucks, go get a new one and then leave. Is easy to say, but I've certainly stayed in terrible jobs where people were appalling, just appalling people being really, really horrible. And like, there was no HR, or I would have gone to HR, but there was some of these small places, there's no HR. So what do you do? All you can do is leave or stay. Those are your options, right? And what you need to do is, yes, get a new job and then leave. That's what you need to do. But it's very hard to summon that confidence to do that when you're being beaten up and bullied all the time. I wasn't being beaten up at work, only psychologically. But like, bullying and battered woman syndrome are closely related, right? Like, when you're bullied, you're not just like your ability to make good choices gets taken away from you. And it's considerable. It's not nothing. He doesn't have to take her shoelaces, because all he has to do is continually bully her. And we meet his mom before we read any of this. And his mom is she's the scariest character I've ever written. I can picture her. Like, she has these black eyes and white hair that's like, sort of moosed, you know, so it's like held down, but it's short, but it's like ripply. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can picture it, but I can't show you because you're not in my head. But like, it's the way she treats people that's just so awful. And her granddaughters meet her and they're like, whoa, no wonder he is the way he is. And that doesn't excuse anybody, but it does explain. Like, they start to understand much better how he turned around and did that to their mom when he was raised by that. Yes, exactly. Okay, so objectively, I didn't want her to be gross, but I did want her to make bad choices, and she still has to make them. Because I want her to be, what's the word? I mean, culpable, yes. Responsible, maybe, is the word. None of this was in previous drafts. She was not responsible for anything. She was just like I was sort of believing her. which is a stupid thing to say, but I was believing her version of events rather than separating. And this is what you have to do with first person, and it is a diary. You have to separate their version of events from reality. There has to be a disconnect between their version and reality, or what are we doing? And so she has to leave things out. So I did have her leave out the gross things. And so it's sort of like subtext. Like she doesn't say it. Like, you wouldn't go to your diary and be like, yeah, I did some really gross stuff today. No, you would just be like, yep, I got some more pills, and not say how you got them. That's what you would do. You would just elide all of the bad things you did, because that's shameful. If you're ashamed of something, you don't go tell your diary, probably. Although I suppose some serial killers have. I'm not sure they're ashamed of themselves, though. They're probably proud. I think if you're ashamed of something, you don't brag about it. That's what I think. And that's what I'm writing. So she does some things. They've all done things they're not proud of. Everybody in this book. And I think it's one of the weirdly adult things about this book. And it's weird to be writing more adult fiction. Did you know Amazon doesn't let you list things as young adult anymore? Why is that? I had to put it in the tags. Why is that not a category anymore? Like, it's not even under genre. I don't get that. They took away young adult. How are you supposed to find young adult novels? You're killing me. Yeah. She is not objective about herself, because she is reinforcing her own learned helplessness with, what, justification, rationalization, all of these things. And the girls in the present are doing the same thing. So I've been thinking a lot about objectivity in terms of narrative objectivity. There is no trustworthy narrator in any of this. This is all point of view. So we're back to the 20-foot Santa and the glowing eyes and the point of view character. Ah, I'm still so scared by that Santa. Why am I so scared by it? I've never had an experience like that. Something with glowing eyes running at me in the dark? Nope. Again, maybe my dog, if her eyes are reflecting the porch light or something. But I'm not afraid of my dog. I've never been afraid of a dog of mine or any other dog. I'm like, all over the state of Maine, going to people's houses, getting furniture. It's just really weird. People are not super rational, I don't think. Anyway, yeah, I'm not afraid of dogs. So I don't know what I'm afraid of. The unknown? Is it the unknown that's running at me out of the darkness? What? I don't know. I would be weirded out if I put that in a book. I never write anything supernatural. I would never. Maybe I should. I did. I wrote some weird things like that in the short story collection. The worst. It's the worst. Yeah, those are about my mom, though, so buckle up. First couple are really grim, but they're also set in reality. Once you get out of reality, they're much better. So anyway, yeah, what's she afraid of? She's afraid of leaving home. She doesn't do it. She should do it, and then she doesn't do it. She should do it, and then she gets pregnant and feels like she can't do it. And it's when you start telling yourself stories about why you can't do these things that you have to realize those are made up. Those are fiction, and you should go to Norway instead of getting a dog. Sorry, Tallulah. You're the best dog. But it was a mistake. I should have gone to Norway. I could have. I'd be in Norway now, unless I got sent home. You never know. If I couldn't get a job, they'd be like, yeah, okay, you don't have a job. Bye. And I do get that panic. I don't write characters like this for no reason. Characters who are like, oh, I can't. I can't get a job. Why can't I get a job? I can't get a job. Dude, go get a job. You can. You can always temp. Temping is terrible, but you can do it. You can do it. Anyway, objectivity, right? That's another failure of objectivity right there. Like, you can do the thing that you don't think you can do. Going to strangers' houses to get 1800s sofas or whatever. Like, on paper, that's terrifying. In reality, I was just like, eh, it's fine. I'll stick my pepper spray in my pocket and my knife. I'm fine. Like, why wouldn't you? But also, of course I wouldn't need it. But also, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? And maybe that's the secret to objectivity, right? Is just to be like, mitigate actual risk, prepare for possible danger, and go do the thing. Like, if I had done that, I'd be living in the land of Norway right now, wouldn't I? Would I have found a job? It's hard to say. I don't know. We don't know because it's fictional. It never happened. I didn't go. And I was gonna go. And then I was like, I was too scared. And being scared is not always rational. Sometimes it is. I always say, like, Murderbot, my risk assessment module is faulty because I'm not scared of what I should be scared of, and I'm very scared of things I shouldn't be scared of. I'm not scared of seeing the orthopedic surgeon. He's a rational person. He is data-oriented. He is evidence-based. Many, many, many doctors I see are not, and they're completely irrational. I saw a doctor. She wasn't a doctor. She was a nurse, a family nurse practitioner. I broke a bone in my foot. I went in there to say, I broke a bone in my foot. I said it to her face with my human mouth. I broke a bone in my foot. It's the fifth metatarsal. Pointed at it. She ignored me and poked my ankle, which also hurts, to be fair, and said, no, you have a sprained ankle. If you had broken a bone in your foot, you wouldn't have been able to walk, which is manifestly untrue. It's untrue. What do you think I was going to do? I was in the woods. Was I just going to fall down and lie there? Like, crawl home through the snow? Like, I had to walk. I had to walk. And I have had to snowblow. I've had to snowblow and do all sorts of things since then. And you can't just say things that are manifestly untrue and expect me to take you seriously. Like, this is why I get so upset with medical people. They're not evidence-based. They're not objective. And I don't like people making decisions about me and for me who are not evidence-based. They need to be evidence-based. Anyway, the orthopedic surgeon is evidence-based. I like that guy. He's fine. I won't see him. I'll see, probably some medical assistant or somebody. But they're all in his office. They're all evidence-based, and I like that. Got shoulder x-ray. We're going to sort it out. My shoulder's so much better today. I don't know what happened, but it's much better, and my foot stopped hurting. What a relief, right? Because I've been in major pain constantly for weeks and weeks, which has not been helping my mood. And then I keep having to snowblow, which is also not helping my mood because it hurts to snowblow both foot and shoulder and hands, to be honest. So pain, don't like it. So objectivity in your own writing, how can you get it? Okay, head injury? No, don't do that. That's my method. Don't do that. Time. You need time. You need time away from a draft in order to come back to it cold. Unless, seriously, if you do have a memory problem like me, it really helps. I'm not kidding. And I'm not recommending one, because it would be nice if I could know who people are when I look at them, which I can't. Unless I met them more than like 8 years ago, then I can recognize them. But if I met them later than 8 years ago, I cannot. It's really weird. What do you need? You need time. You need time. And you need clarity of mission. Like, you're going to go in and go, okay, I'm reading for plot. I'm reading for character. I'm reading for plausibility. I'm reading in a hostile reader way. You can do a hostile reader read. That is always a good thing to do. Although, make sure you do all the other ones first. But when you get to a bunch of it done and you're mostly done with your rewrite, come at it like a hostile reader. Imagine some jackass, you know, who would come at your reading and be like, that would never happen. This is stupid. I don't like this. Just imagine that person with that voice and use that and read it from that point of view. It'll probably give you self-loathing, but you can survive that because it'll make you pick up on things where you're like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess maybe this could be a little implausible. So I'm going to back up and I'm going to make it so it's totally plausible. All right. Give yourself that hateful reader read. Hopefully you'll never have a hateful reader, but if you do, you will have that. So that's a later one. Earlier ones, really good ways to be objective are outline after the fact. Like, go back and look at it. Don't go by your memory, because your memory is either a friend or foe, depending on what it wants you to do and doesn't want you to do. Plus, your brain wants to keep you safe. Your brain will be like, it's fine. You don't have to do it anymore. It's great. Go play. Which is not in your best interest, really, because you need to rewrite it and make it better. But it seems like it's in your best interest because it means you're done. Yay, you get to run away and play, which is not really good for your book. You need to be able to look at it and see what's wrong with it. So outlining after the fact makes you actually look at the facts on the page. Okay, and I'm sure I've said before, but I used to do this with screenwriting students. Go through your script and to the side of, okay, every slug line, that scene, write what happens, what it accomplishes. Let's put it that way. What does the scene do? What does it do for your story? And it might be like, introduces George, or, you know, brings in conflict between George and Mary. Okay, good. If you find that you have seven scenes that are introducing the conflict between George and Mary, or it stays at the same level for seven scenes, you have some chopping to do or some combining. Because once you're looking at function is an important word here. Once you're looking at the function of a scene, then you know whether or not to keep it. It may be, you know, humor or changing the mood or, you know, relief from that really heavy scene we had before. Or it may be, here's how awful their grandmother is. Or here's how Lisette made terrible choices. Or here she is trying to save herself. Or here's the day. Because that's not what the function is. The function of a scene where Lisette tries to save herself by packing up a backpack and walking out the front door and just going after he cuts off the landline and leaves her there with no cell phone. We kind of hate this guy. It's okay. It's okay to hate this guy. So after that, if she packs up all her stuff and walks out the front door, what's the function of that? The function of that is we respect her a little more. We respect her gumption. She knows she's pregnant. She knows she has nowhere to go, really. Her best friend is dead. Her boyfriend is in college. She can't go there. She can't go live in a dorm. You know, like, she has nowhere to go, really. But she goes out the front door and starts walking. And what happens? Oh, no. I don't know because I haven't written it yet. But obviously it can't go great, can it? Like, she's made all the phone calls she can before the landline got taken away. But it didn't solve anything. And she's tried and tried and tried. And he fired the guys who work in the landscaping guys. He fired them. So she doesn't have any help. The housekeeper got fired. Like, she's left there alone because he doesn't want her to have any partisans or any help against him. He feels like everyone's plotting against him. He is kind of paranoid. And so, yeah, what if she just starts walking? What happens when she starts walking? I don't know. I'll have to write it and see. But the function of that scene would be we respect her more. We see she has agency. Maybe she even understands she has agency. She didn't maybe do it right. But just because you didn't do it right doesn't mean you don't have agency. So the function of a scene is very important. So yes, objectivity is very well suited by outlining after the fact. Not before the fact, because that's a fictional outline about a fictional book, but after the fact is an outline of a real book that exists on the page. So you go back and, like, I don't know if you have chapters in yours or whatever. I don't have chapters necessarily. I guess I did break it into chapters by day because it was helping me to figure out where to put the diary entries, one per day. And that helps me because I have a lot of trouble understanding organization of a finished document. I have to have chapters or I can't find anything. And then you can search. You can search for the word chapter, and then it's a lot easier to find things. So you go to your outline, you go chapter one. Okay, back and forth between these two. They talk about that. They get to the place. They do the thing. They meet so-and-so. They find out what's going on. They go to the room. One is hostile. One is nice. One, whatever. What is your function there, though? Like, don't just say events. Go by function. It establishes the characters and the locations and the conflict between the two of them, as well as their goals. The goals are a big thing because you don't want a mushy plot. So it establishes all those things. Chapter one is huge. Chapter one has to do everything. It has to give us your tone and your voice and the style and everything all at once. And chapter one's hard. You're going to have to probably rewrite chapter one a lot. I've rewritten chapter one probably 30 times. I'm really tired. Some of those were previous drafts, though, previous versions of the story. But I keep coming back to it because it's something that I need to work on. I really like this story because it really is about agency and how much you have and how much you give up and how much you lose to your own internal crisis that you're having about things. Like, these two, all three of these girls, like their mom and the two daughters, we're hearing from them when they're 16. And 16 is a tough age because you're just grasping your own agency. And you have been a child your whole life, a person with limited agency. And so you're suddenly learning what it is and how to have it. And maybe you're getting a little bit more separation from parents and their control. And so you have to, you know, you're out on the bike for the first time, metaphorically, wobbling down the road and suddenly going, oh, I have to pedal and that'll make me balance and da-da, you know, follow the metaphor where it goes. And then I can ride the bike. So this is a story, like everything I write, about agency and about understanding that you have it and learning how to use it. And so establishing the characters establishes how little they have at the beginning. And they have it, they just don't know it yet. And they haven't grasped it yet that they have it. And they make choices, like, again, like I said before, everybody makes bad choices. These two, their choices are more in their coping at this point, because they're sort of in this situation where they don't have a lot of control. Though they immediately take control back. Like, you know, their dad says, well, we're going to fix up the house. And the one girl is like, yeah, $25 an hour. We start at 10 every day. We get a lunch after 3 hours. Like, she just immediately is like, actually, no. And then, so they negotiate that. And then she's like, I don't want to do this. Do you want to do this? What's the point of having all that money? You don't seem like you want to do it. And he's like, actually, I don't want to do it. I just thought we should. I thought we should do a project together to bond. And she's like, hell with that. Let's go do something fun. And they go do something else while they go to their mom's grave. But still, like, they have their own agenda and they realize they have agency and they can actually make it happen, which is huge. It's huge. Everything I write is about agency and realizing you have it and learning how to use it, especially fighting learned helplessness, which they all have to one degree or another. All of them, including the dad, who has to learn to overcome it by the help of his daughters, who are, you know, very, very different, but dealing with similar badness in their lives. So there you go. Objectivity when looking at your own writing means you can't think about what it should be. You have to look at what it is. It's so hard. It's really hard. It took me a very long time to be able to do it. And you can't feel bad. I forbid you to feel bad when you're reading your own writing. Instead of that, go back and actually do think of what it should be. Compare what it is to what it should be and figure out the difference. And that sounds easy for me to say. I know how hard it is. I have been banging my head against the wall all week on this, all year, for basically a year. Yeah, I've been banging my head against this book because it's hard. It's a hard story to tell. It's hard. Like, why didn't I make it easy? Just tell a straightforward story. But I wanted to have the girls, and I wanted to have the point of view of their mom when she was their age and making really boneheaded choices left and right. Really boneheaded. She's a smart girl who acts really dumb. Straight A's in molecular biology and whatnot, but then she's been sheltered. Yeah, that's what makes you make dumb choices. I mean, you have to make them when you first step out of the safe area anyway. You have to make some choices and you got to screw things up or you're never going to learn anything. But oh, she makes some choices. And they all do this in various ways. Like, you're miserable. What do you do? I need to make it better. What's going to make it better? A substance? Like, that's a choice. And yes, I'm always going on about maladaptive coping mechanisms, but that is a choice people make constantly every single day of the week on planet Earth. People will choose a substance rather than cope in any productive way. Like, we all do it, right? Coffee or whatever, even. Like, yeah, we all do it and they all do it. And it's not helpful. But it does help in the short term a lot. And if you're in a crisis, sometimes you just solve the short term and then you let tomorrow figure itself out, which really isn't great. But, you know, like I said, they're all 16 and variously screwed up. So, all right. Objectivity. A really good way to get this also is by reading other people's work, which I sort of did by reading my own work because, like I said, I don't remember. But I read all three of those Lainey Taylor books before I read mine, and they really gave me an interesting insight into what works, what doesn't, and constantly going back to the same well, which is something obviously I do, and maybe have to quit it, like write about something else next time. I don't know, though. A.S. King always writes about agency, and her books are amazing. She always writes about people who are stuck, who have to figure out they have agency. Every book. And then it always works. It always works really well. So I might not quit. We'll see. If you have any ideas for what you want me to read and talk about, please send me an email, sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com. And let me know. Let me know what you're working on in your own writing. Rewriting is sad and lonely because you don't get that joyous rush you get from writing new work. At least I do. Writing a first draft is like the best feeling. It gives me all these really good brain chemicals, which is why I have so many. And drafts, not brain chemicals. And rewriting is like work. And so it's a lot easier to write something new than to fix up something old. But you have to finish things. You have to finish things. You're not done until you're done. You got to get them fixed up and worked up and made right and good. And I do have some sad old novels out there that are never going to get that treatment because I would have to rewrite them from page one, like I did with this one. And that's a lot of work. And sometimes I want to do something else. So that's that. Rewriting is, it's like grading papers. It really is. It's like, it's just analytical and it's work and you have to keep at it. And maybe that's another thing is like, you don't have to do it all at once. You can't do it all at once. I always want to. I just want to whoosh through, you know, like 300-400 pages of book and like, no, you can't. You can't read it like you're reading something. You have to read it slowly and you have to be cold and you have to notice everything and not let anything slip by. And that's very hard. And I catch myself doing things like noticing something and going, oh yeah, I have to get that in the rewrite. Wait, this is the rewrite. I have to fix it now. Stop and fix it now. And the concentration part is hard because you kind of have to hold the whole thing in your head to know how all the pieces fit together, but you kind of can't do that and fix things. Like I said, you can't look at the map and drive. And so you have to go through it and fix things, and then you have to go through it and fix things, and then you have to go through it and fix things. It's fine. It's just how it is. It's hard. I'm not going to lie. It is not easy. And it's exhausting. And I think I should probably go write a new draft of something else just to get a break from it because I'm really compulsive and I want to keep going until I'm done. But that's a recipe for disaster. Like, that's really not a good idea because I just get tired. And then when you get tired, you miss things and you make mistakes. And nobody needs that. We need everything to get fixed. Like, how does it help if I have to go through it again and fix it again? It doesn't help. So try not to be so restless. Slow down. It's okay. All right. So please do let me know if you have a text in mind. All right. I will come back next week with a text I did not write and more, hopefully, work done on frickin' Summerlands. You think you're tired of hearing about it. It's been all day, every day, forever. So we'll see what I work on next week. We'll see. Hopefully something good. All right, I hope you're doing really well. I hope you're surviving fascism. I hope you've got supplies in for now. Apparently we're having an economic war with Canada and Mexico. So that's great. Bunch of geniuses. All right, we will figure this out. Hang in there and focus, as always, on the sacred cheese of life. Bye.